Good morning. Today is a Tuesday, 20th of February. Joining us this morning, pinch hitting. So we're going to go with spring training analogies because everybody's now reported. We got our first broadcast this weekend.
Oh, gotcha.
So you're pinch hitting.
Pinch hitting.
You're not substituting for.
No.
No. You're on the big league roster.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Jeff Stackhouse from the Cooperative Extension at Spruce Point. Pinch hitting for the skier. We'll just kind of leave it there.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah, we had plenty of discussion about the intellect associated with skiing earlier.
Yeah.
Probably just, well, you know what? I bet you we wouldn't get too many people mad.
No, because they're all gone.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah,
They won't pick us up from Bend, Ashland.
She might listen to it after it's a podcast.
Yeah, she doesn't have time for that, I don't think.
No.
We're probably safe.
Yeah, huh? It's called checking in. You ready for your question, sir?
Oh, no.
Oh, good. Oh, well, this is almost an outdoorsy question.
Okay.
Why, when someone is betrayed, do we say that they have been sold down the river?
Oh. I don't know. Because the fur trade.
Okay. You might, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the Mississippi was involved in the fur trade.
Yeah.
Okay. After 1808, it was illegal for deep Southerners to import slaves. So they were brought down the Mississippi River from the north to the slave markets of Natchez and New Orleans. This gave the Northerners a way of selling off their difficult or troublesome slaves to the harsher plantation owners of the southern Mississippi. And it meant that those selected or betrayed would be torn from their homes and families to be sold downriver.
Huh. That's not a very nice story.
No. No.
It's interesting that there's such a large cultural difference, though.
Well, you know, unless you travel a lot, you really don't understand how large we really are.
That's true.
I mean, what, was it 3,000 miles, coast to coast, roughly? Okay. So at 100 miles an hour, that's a day. That's over 2 days of driving.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a 100
miles an hour. Yeah, yeah. You start putting some numbers to things, and you go, well, okay, maybe that's why it takes so long to fly.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I don't have a clue how. Okay, so if we're roughly 3,000 miles wide, how tall are we? North to south. I've never.
1,500? I don't know. I don't have a clue either.
No clue.
1,000.
No. California's longer than that.
My wife and I drove to northern Mexico where her father-in-law bought a house.
Yeah.
San Felipe. It was a long ways to get there.
Yeah.
We went there for Christmas. I was like, shoot, it's only 18, 19 hours. That's not a big deal. It wasn't a big deal when I was in my 20s.
Yeah. Gray hair changes one's perspective.
Oh, man.
Yeah. No kidding. Oh. So what are you seeing out there these days? Anything exciting? Or is the – I don't want to say – lots of rainfall, because it's not. It's normal rainfall for us.
Yeah.
Are you seeing signs of normalcy out there?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Everyone's complaining about being wet, including myself, because it is. I mean, there's a lot of water. And that's probably the number one limiting factor for what we're seeing in terms of ag production right now, in terms of forage growth, like grass growth.
Well, you need water.
Well, it's... The roots are so saturated, the poor plants can't breathe right now. But the cool part, the non-cool part, I guess, is since the fall, we got some early rains, we got some early growth, which is really good for the livestock production and grass production, right? But the most notable thing, I think, about this winter that's different than other winters is we didn't get our usual cold spells. So our growing...
Yeah, the frost.
Yeah, so we didn't get our frost, usually the last week of December and the first 3 weeks of January or so.
Yeah, when we get the cool, clear weather.
Exactly. Cool, clear weather, dries stuff out, and stops grass growth because we get under the required what's called growing degree days, which is basically there's kind of a sweet spot around 100 growing degree days. And a growing degree day is you just take the highest temperature of the day, add it to the lowest temperature of the day. So I don't know what the
And the two of them
forecast
together.
Forecast is today, to... yeah. But say it's 40 degrees tonight.
Wet.
40, yeah, wet. But say it's 40 degrees is our low tonight and our high is 60. That gets you to this magic number of about 100. And somewhere between 100 and 110 is when things really start growing in the world of cool season grasses.
So if it's below that, it dormant?
Yeah.
I mean, a one-day dormancy?
Yeah, basically. It just doesn't grow because the soils get cold enough that it doesn't want to do
its thing. So the moisture itself, that must be an inhibitor as well.
Yeah, correct. So the moisture, I mean, obviously you need moisture for the plants to grow. But if you get saturation, it becomes an inhibitor and decreases plant health, which is what we're seeing right now. Is the moisture is holding us back, not the temperatures. At least for the low ground. The high ground up, you know, Bridgeville, Neyland, is still getting cold enough where they're not meeting that sweet spot for temperature.
And it's draining off a little bit quicker.
Yeah, and it's running downhill to the rest of us. Yeah.
When it gets saturated like that, Jeff, do the roots just kind of shut down, or the whole system of the plant just shut down because it's too much moisture?
Yeah, basically, there's no oxygen in the root zone, so those plants have a hard time moving the nutrients where they need to go as they photosynthesize.
Spring, summer, fall, you know, if we're watering our plants outside, it seems to take a ton of water before you get like 1 inch down. I'm thinking like roses and things of that nature that
sure
need that saturation. How much does it take rainfall to get to that same point where it's actually getting down into the root zone?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not an expert in that. It'd be a better question for Eddie Tanner, our horticulture person. I mean, of course, it's going to depend on timing and quantity, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. If you get it all in 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. I really don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
But, I mean, all we're doing...
Because that's an indicator for the livestock, isn't it? Yeah, if the feed is available.
Yeah.
Okay, we can sustain some critters.
Yeah, exactly.
If it's all dead, not so much.
Livestock and range science is pretty... We call it a soft science, right? It's look out the side of the pickup as you drive by, and if it looks like there's some grass there, you can put some more cows out there.
intuition and experience, I think.
Yeah,
it's like,
that's what we're talking about. Yeah. Intuition and experience.
KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:19.
Murphy's Markets has everything you need to get through your day the healthy way. From drinks to snacks and everything in between, right now, Amy and Brian coconut water is only $1.99. Brew Dr. Kombucha drinks are also just $1.99. And Annie's homegrown products are $2.49. A 6-ounce Yoplait yogurt is only 79 cents. And don't forget about chicken of the sea tuna, 4 for $5. Get a boost for your day by stopping by Murphy's Markets, more than a grocer, your neighbor since 1971.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Jeff Stackhouse from the Cooperative Extension. What are some of the challenges that new to the industry folks experience when they're either after they've already made the financial commitment or they're considering, they're doing the exploring of, hey, that kind of looks like it might be, you know, get a truck, be macho a little bit,
yeah,
you know, pull a trailer around. Watch cows walk around in the field. Yeah, it doesn't sound that tough.
Yeah. No, that's it.
Now, you don't hear the phrase gentleman rancher. You hear gentleman farmer.
Oh, you don't hear
not
gentleman
a gentleman rancher.
Rancher.
Well, now, does that mean that there are no gentlemen?
Gentlemen's Association needs to step it up on their marketing, apparently. No, that's a great question, and it's one that I actually face frequently in my line of work. If someone calls me, They want to get into the livestock business.
Oh, there is a lot of interest in that.
Oh yeah, the back to the land movement. The homesteading movement or whatever it is you want to call it now. I have a lot of people calling me on a weekly basis with small acreage that want to get a diversified farm going, and they want one beef cow, a couple sheep, a couple goats, and a dairy cow, for example, right?
It sounds like it's growing like tomatoes in the backyard.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that scale, just yeah, really micro,
yeah.
micro.
Yeah, it is that scale. Or it's someone that has a vegetable business that wants to diversify with livestock. And it's a great idea in concept, but I always ask, the first question I try to ask people is, do you own them or do they own you? Like, if you want to go on vacation, like, it doesn't matter if you have 500 milk cows or one milk cow, you have to be there to milk it twice a day. So are you making a living off of this animal, or is this animal making a living off of you? Right? So that's kind of where I like to start the conversation. And then there's a whole, the obvious things of knowledge and, medications and feeding and blah, 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 blah. But the fundamental piece is really, okay, if you want one beef cow so you can eat one steer a year or sell it or whatever you're going to do with it. That also means you have to have one bull to service that cow.
To keep.
Because the eggs need semen to be fertile to
right.
have an offspring. So now you have a bull that's sitting over here in pen A.
Not doing a heck of a lot.
Not doing a whole lot all year to service your one cow that's providing you something to eat. And then you have two sheep. Well, you need one ram for your two sheep. So now, it just snowballs into.
Basically, it sounds like it's animal husbandry 101.
That's exactly what it is.
Have you considered?
Have you thought about this? And do you know that it rains in Humboldt County a heck of a lot? And these animals need dry places to be, and they need open space to go feed. And then their hay needs somewhere to be. And then, like you said earlier, you need a truck, and then you need a trailer. And then, to have a unit of one of most of these things is quite similar to have a unit of 100 of them. So the small scale.
So jump
doesn't
in,
pencil.
Jump in the deep end unless you want to have a pet.
Yeah.
Kind of, sort of. That's interesting. My thought was, what your first question was? Why?
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 Yeah. But then there's...
Now, there may be great reasons.
Yeah.
Have you thought through this? And that's kind of what you're getting to with the multiplying factor there.
Yeah, and then there's other livestock classes that are very feasible, right? You could raise turkeys. You get them in the late spring, early summer, and they are finished with their production cycle at Thanksgiving. So you're not housing these animals.
Kind of coincidental, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But you're not housing these animals in the winter. You have them during the time of year when the weather is favorable. And then, it's an open, closed book. Not same, but similar would be, having a bunch of chickens that you get eggs from. At least those you can get a door that opens and closes automatically on their coop so you can go on vacation and they can feed themselves.
Right. So they figured that part out.
Yeah. So there's production classes that make more sense than others for people that want to dabble in it but don't want to go full scale.
I would think it's similar to families that get the daughter a pony and don't really understand what that means as far as the maintenance and the upkeep and the cost and the.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They live.
Yeah. Well, it's like those, what are those birds? Parrot? No, not parrots.
All of those birds.
Yeah, like 50 years. It's like, you're going to pass this one on to your kids or what?
Yeah.
You got to think about some of these. Do the research, I guess, is a base level. Do your research first.
Yeah.
Instead of realizing what you're into after you're into it. Are there, support groups for gentlemen ranchers?
for gentleman ranchers?
Information. Gee, I wish I would have knowns. Basic minimums. Is that what the internet kind of provides? Is that opportunity?
I think, the internet and social media is filling that niche. There's also trade organizations like the California Cattlemen's Association that is in almost every county. Like, we have the Humboldt Del Norte Cattlemen's Association. It's a place for people to get together, meet each other, share information.
Get laughed at. Oh, maybe it's just you that gets laughed at.
I think so.
All right. It's 8:30.
Something big.
Okay, it's a nice ride.
It's going to happen.
Stand by playback.
And now.
Meet Radio.
I keep forgetting I'm president.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
Good morning, KINS. News and Information Time is 8:35. We're back talking shop this morning with Jeff Stackhouse. Jeff, as you consider some of the different options that are in the area, I know some of your compatriots looking and see potential in certain areas. If you look at Humboldt County history, sheep were a big deal for a long time.
Yeah.
Did the market shift underneath? Were there other areas that stepped up? Or did sheep just become uncool and shift to something else?
Yeah. I don't have any, real data to support me. If you ask families that were in the sheep industry, most of them blame the predator population, so the coyotes. Apparently, this is way before my time, but coyotes didn't exist in Humboldt County. And there was other tools afforded to people back in the day to help with predators.
You mean guns?
More poisons. Like poisons, okay. Yeah. So if there was a problem, it
control
could be...
Control agents.
Control agents, yes. So if there was a problem, it could be exterminated, right?
Oh, good word.
Yes. So that is what I hear blame the most with the loss of our sheep industry locally.
There are meals on wheels, so to speak.
Yeah.
They're
low hanging fruit for all predators. Right now, one of the largest, the largest sheep producer in our county is really struggling with bears, for example, just because of their geographic location. But in the traditional sheep ground, the coyote is the one that is blamed the most. For what happened to those industries. I think that there's also some other coupled factors, like you suggested. After World War II, when people came back from the war, they didn't really want to see sheep on their plate. They ate a lot of mutton when they were overseas fighting those fights. So like my grandfather, for example, I grew up on a sheep ranch. We had 400 ewes. And when my grandfather came to visit, everyone else ate lamb, and my grandfather got a beefsteak that we bought at the store because he wouldn't touch it. So I think that there was...
He had his ratio.
He had all the lamb he wanted, and he was not going to eat it another day of his life. So I think that some of that passed down, and I think that we're seeing some of that change, but I think that there's definitely some of the preference changes from that era. The other piece of it that is largely different than it used to be is the alternative fiber sources, right? Wool was the most profitable piece of the sheep industry for a very long time. The meat was just a byproduct. And now that is completely flipped on its head, where the meat is the main income source And the wool, for the most part, I mean, this is an over-exaggeration in some ways, depending on the breed, but for the most part, it costs you more to remove the wool off of the sheep every year than the wool is worth. So having a shearer come and shear the things costs you more than it does to sell, you know, than you're getting from the sale of the fleeces.
So we got to go back to wool baseball uniforms.
Yes. Yeah, wool baseball uniforms, wool, you know, wool
jackets,
military uniforms, like,
yeah, like
blankets, yeah, everything, yeah, right? I mean, I'm wearing wool today, but probably not too many people are. But at any rate, so there's that. And then the other piece that I'd really, really know the least about is, and it's true for most industries, like for example, there's a saying that goes around in the beef industry that, you know, I can sell, in 1975, I could sell 3 steers and go buy a brand new pickup. And in 2015, I can sell the same 3 steers and go buy the same pickup.
Because it's used and it's got 150,000 miles.
Because it's got 300,000 miles on it. It's a 1975 pickup. And you know, you're selling those.
And the bed is rusted out.
And the bed's rusted out. Yeah, you're selling 3 1,000-pound steers at $1.50 a pound, which was the same price you could sell them for in the 70s, you know. But the depreciation on that pickup after it's, whatever, 40
wear
years
and tear.
Old.
Yeah. It's intriguing because I would think that beef is still top of the list.
I think so, yeah.
But maybe there's just different cuts that are preferred.
I think it's just it's true for all agriculture. Agriculture is subsidized tremendously in the United States, and that keeps the prices low for the consumers. And our grocery bills, although everyone has felt them get more expensive in the last year, our grocery bills are very cheap compared to the cost of production.
The ratio just is kind of out of whack.
Yeah. Yeah, the price of our produce in the store has not kept up with inflation.
Well, and getting things to market, you know, is probably where we're getting tagged with a lot of those increases.
Yeah.
Which isn't at the producer level.
And yeah.
It's not at the wholesale level. It's in between.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, like, going back to the size of the nation and, you know, where things flow. So most of our beef operations in Humboldt County are called cow-calf operations. So the commodity they're selling is not a steak. The commodity they're selling is a calf. So they are, you know.
So the baby goes and matures somewhere else.
Correct, yeah. So it's cheaper to ship animals to feed than it is to ship feed to animals, right? So think about energy sources in the United States. Our main energy source for our climate and our culture is corn. So we take our calves from Humboldt County, the furthest west spot in the United States, and they go on trucks to Colorado, Nebraska, anywhere in the Midwest where the corn is grown, and that's where they, you know,
Beef up.
Yeah, exactly.
Good, you can use that phrase.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's good. But that's where they end their life cycle, and that's where the plants are to process them, and then they get shipped back to the West Coast for consumption.
In butcher paper.
Yeah. But, yeah. I mean, so that's kind of the big California picture. Locally, we obviously have a lot of niche markets. We are blessed to have Redwood Meats, which is such a key piece of our local agriculture in terms of livestock.
But niche really is a self-defining limiter.
Yeah.
You just get to a certain point and that's all that there is.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't think that there's, even if you maximize production to the nth degree, is there enough for a second processor?
Yeah.
Probably not.
I don't know.
So, okay. It's never going to be. Will always be an importer.
Yeah, I think so.
So to speak. What is the trendy animal now? Is there one? For those or I guess for livestock purposes, for commercial purposes. Is there any Are pigs cool now, or
I don't know the answer.
Chickens,
to
that. Or I mean, it seems like a lot of chicken is being consumed. But as you indicated, chickens kind of can happen anywhere, can't they?
Yeah.
I mean, anyway. Think of Arkansas. There's a guy there, the Purdue family. Tend to have a couple of chickens.
They got a couple of chickens.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that in terms of what's trending. Like, in the world of beef, Wagyu is trending there for a while. It seems, I don't know the numbers, so I shouldn't even speak to it, but it seems to be tailing off a little bit. When beef prices were very high and milk prices were very low, we were seeing a lot of beef semen, so Angus semen or Charolais semen, being used on dairy cows, so that way their calves would be more fit for the beef industry than they would be for the milk industry. But now that milk's starting to come back, that seems to be tailing off a little bit. So I don't really know what the trend is currently, to be honest. I don't know what the commercial picture looks like for the United States.
And there's got to be regional pockets within that, too.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And whatever's hot in Texas probably doesn't play too well in the Dakotas.
Yeah.
Just as an example. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:44.
Hearty and healthy foods are abundant at Murphy's Markets. USDA Choice Boneless Beef Chuck Roast is now $5.99 a pound. USDA Choice New York Strip Steak, $15.99 a pound. And USDA Grade A Boneless Skinless Chicken Thighs are only $3.99 a pound. Complement this with a Greek salad, now just $7.99 a pound, topped with Kraft salad dressing for only $3.75 for a 16-ounce bottle. Murphy's Markets, more than a grocer, your neighbor since 1971.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:49. We're back talking shop this morning with Jeff Stackhouse from the UC Cooperative Extension. All right, just so you don't get lit up at Spruce Point. We're trying to keep that that moniker, that geographic location alive.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think many people even
know where Spruce Point,
Spruce Point is. Yeah, because it doesn't get referenced anymore.
What do they call it? Humble Hill?
South Broadway. Oh. You know, it's like, okay. Yeah, or at the foot of Humboldt Hill. Oh, dandy. Okay.
I don't have any preferences. So
whatever. Well, that's because you came from the valley, turkey.
Yeah. Whatever's clever.
So what is the big project that you're looking at for this spring, summer? Is there anything that's out there? Are you doing any kind of testing or monitoring or tracking, or are you getting a lot of questions in one area that this year, 24, you're going to be able to get your teeth into?
Oh, that's a good question. I'll tell you what I'm doing this week. The bigger projects coming are a little dependent on whether we get funding or not, because a lot of those large projects require extra staff and sampling and things, and the funding cycles drive whether we have the capabilities to pay the labs to do the work, because we don't have the labs locally.
Oh, so it's not the gathering of the information. So if Humboldt's kids helped you out, great. So now you got a whole bunch of stuff now that you can't do anything with.
Correct, yeah. Okay. It's most of the work that we do that has high costs associated with it is the lab work, right? So if, for example, if I'm doing, like last year I was doing a bunch of dewormer trials where we were taking fecal samples from cows after they'd been treated, and we were trying to figure out, you know, what specific species of worms inside their gut were being, you know, were exhibiting existence to our treatments, right? So for that, we had to send half of the fecal sample to UC Davis to do genomic testing on one type of worms, and then the other half had to go to Texas A&M to get genomic testing on the other species of worms, because I don't remember who
they're
did
experts
what. They're experts. So like Texas was doing the tapeworms and UC Davis was doing the flatworms or some. I don't remember who was doing what. But essentially, instead of paying one institution or lab, you know, the $200 per sample, we got to double it. And, you know, it ended up for each cow we were testing was almost $500 a cow. So it gets very expensive.
And you need enough critical mass.
Yeah, and you need
to get any information that's statistically viable.
Yeah, from numerous properties and numerous landowners doing different treatments. So you can spend $500,000 pretty quickly when you're doing that kind of work.
So do the ranchers participate in that, or is this the UC system?
No,
it's all of the testing to get that information.
So we're paying for the testing, but the ranchers or cooperators that work with me are all voluntary. It costs them a ton of time and labor to deal with me slowing them down. They have to gather their cows on days they don't want to gather them. They have to work them on days they don't want to gather them. I have to get weights on each of them because the whole point is to determine.
You have to weigh the cow out in the field?
Yeah, on that project, we were trying to decide whether. So we know a few things. We know that deworming cows reduces the worm load. We know that worms, if they reach a critical mass, decrease weight gains on cows. We know that there's worm populations that have developed resistance to wormers. What we don't know is at what threshold of worms do you have a problem and you can actually detect losses in livestock gains.
The tipping point.
Yeah, exactly. And that tipping point is where you see a financial difference, is because what you're selling at the end of the day is pounds of beef, and if those worms are decreasing the pounds of beef through rate of gain, then you see a problem. But is it worth treating if there's not a problem?
That's where your ROI is.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it'll keep you busy.
Yeah, yeah. And each of those steps is its own research project, right? So it's one of those things that just never. It's a gift that keeps on giving. Yeah.
Hey, way to go, bud. Thanks for coming in. At least we weren't skiing, huh?
Yeah, at least we weren't dying on a mountain.
See everybody tomorrow.